From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone, listening on Scared Monkeys Radio and watching on Access Channel 7. One of my favorite guests is Richard Moody. He's an author, a mayor, a prosecutor. He's done just about everything. In his most recent book, I got to get this right this time. I screwed it up last time. Chantani, the Sinatra legend at 100, is back in the news, and it's making all sorts of waves that Richard will talk about. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Thanks a lot, Dana, and you nailed it this time.
Did I get it? I didn't screw it up. That's
no, great. You got it right this time. Thank you.
Tell me, it's been a couple of months since we've had you on talking about the book. What is new with the book?
Sales are going very, very well. The book was recently named an award finalist in the USA Book News Best Book Competition for biography category. Biography of Frank Sinatra, of course. Yeah. And one good thing that was just happening this past month is that the book was selected by the New Jersey State Library as an audiobook for the blind.
Wow. That's
cool. They have recorded the book. It's available now for the blind, not just in New Jersey, but across the USA, and I hope it's also available in Canada.
I'm sure it is. That's fantastic. Now, what brings such a fascination with the celebrity, Sinatra, Elvis, and that many, many years, not just one or two, but 20, 30, 40 years later, people are still as fascinated, and there's a whole new generation wanting to learn more about them.
Well, Sinatra was not only the consummate entertainer of the 20th century. I mean, he could act when he put his mind to it. Sometimes he just phoned it in. He didn't really spend any time studying a role or the script or anything like that, but when he put his mind to it, as in From Here to Eternity and The Man with the Golden Arm and The Manchurian Candidate, he really delivered a stellar performance. So there was that aspect of him, singer and entertainer and just outright the most fascinating personality of the century, too. I mean, he had his ring-a-ding-ding lifestyle that overshadowed any other entertainer of the era.
It was interesting. A couple of nights ago, I'm in not a swanky restaurant, but a very nice atmosphere restaurant. In the background, instead of loud nonsense-type music, I'm listening to Frank Sinatra, and, you know, the majority of the patrons in there, I'm sad to say, were a lot younger than me, and they were enjoying the music, too. So that's fantastic. Richard Moody's here. We're talking about his book, Chantani, the Sinatra Legend at 100. Plus, we're going to talk to Richard about a lot more things, too, that are going on. And one thing that Frank Sinatra did was support his favorite politician, and we're right in the middle of a political fight that I'm sure Frank Sinatra would sit back and laugh about, and you as a politician are probably sitting back and laughing about or shaking your head about. What about that, Sinatra? What do you think he would think about today?
I think he'd probably, toward the later part of his life, he became a right-wing Republican.
Oh, yeah.
He started out as a very liberal Democrat supporting Franklin Roosevelt, stuck with Kennedy, as a matter of fact, and I can tell this story later if we have time, but without Frank Sinatra's help, John F. Kennedy would never have become president of the United States. But Kennedy sort of disrespected Sinatra over Sinatra's mob connections, and Sinatra gradually drifted into the Republican camp. He supported Richard Nixon, thanks to his friendship with Spiro Agnew, and also Ronald Reagan. And I think if he were around today, he'd probably be looking for a moderate Republican. I think Reagan would be considered a moderate Republican today. I don't think Sinatra would venture into the extreme right wing of the party these days.
What do you think? What does Richard Muti think of the political nonsense? Big day tomorrow, Super Tuesday, and I, you know, in all my days, and of course I'm in Canada, but watching this is as fascinating as it is annoying, and you got to wonder what the election process is like in that country of yours.
As you mentioned, I was a mayor of my hometown in Ramsey, New Jersey. I ran as a Democrat and was elected as a Democrat in a heavily Republican town, ousting a four-term incumbent Republican mayor. While mayor, I became an independent because I didn't like the way the local and state Democratic Party was drifting. Became an independent. And I still consider myself an independent. I tend to be on the conservative side. On economic issues, on the progressive side, on social issues. But in looking at the race, I'm not a big fan of Hillary Clinton. I'm not so far progressive that I really think Bernie Sanders has a lot to offer the United States. But the Republican side is really a mess as far as I'm concerned. Okay. I like John Kasich very much. Governor of Ohio. I think he's a stalwart Republican, but one with some common sense approach to the problems. Everyone else in the field, I really am not thrilled about at all.
Yeah, it's, well, we'll talk about it more as the night goes on, but it's certainly something that makes you wonder. Now, also in your story career, you spent time as a prosecutor, and one thing we're not hearing a lot about. We just had a young policewoman, her very first day on the job, killed in a domestic situation. A couple of other officers shot. The war on police, so to speak. Chris Rock took a jab at law enforcement at the Academy Awards, for heaven's sakes. You know, this political correctness and this attack on police is something that... Well, it made me retire from the profession. It's just not the same as it used to be, and I'm really curious to hear what you think because it's much more defined in your country.
I'm just really disturbed about it. FBI Director James Comey, who I think is probably one of the people in the United States right now with the highest level of integrity. I really trust him a lot. James Comey, we can go into his background, but during the George W. Bush administration, he threatened to resign because Bush administration wanted him to do something that he thought was unethical. In any event, he himself said not too long ago that this anti-police attitude is really hurting law enforcement throughout the country. Not only is it demoralizing police, it's making them less willing to go beyond, above and beyond, as they often were called to do in doing their duty. But I just think it's terrible. I don't see any reasoned voices besides James Comey, certainly not among the politicians, really approaching the subject with any degree of integrity or reasonableness, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, they're not talking about it, and I think that's the point that's most disappointing. But nevertheless, we're going to interject with Sinatra here and talk about current events as we see them, because I think they're both so fascinating. And the book, again, Chintani, the Sinatra Legend 100, is fantastic. I've read it once, and I'm reading it, going through it again. It's always interesting to see the old newsreels and the documentaries and the things that come out. And one thing that, you know, with all the mafia ties and all of that, Sinatra was very pro-law enforcement, especially when his son was kidnapped. He was on the side of the cops, was he not?
Well, his son was kidnapped not long after JFK was assassinated. Frank Sinatra Jr. was kidnapped in early December 1963, and Sinatra reached out to Robert Kennedy, who was the Attorney General at the time, and also spoke with J. Edgar Hoover, and they put all of the resources of the FBI and the Justice Department into the search for Sinatra's son. Luckily, it came out story had a happy ending, and Sinatra Jr. was released by the kidnappers, who were really amateurs, released by the kidnappers, and most of the ransom money that Sinatra had paid was recovered. But it was certainly law enforcement really helping out a celebrity, but law enforcement helps out the little guy, too.
Yeah, for sure. You know, the mafia connection with Frank Sinatra, his testimony before Congress or whatever that was then, and I think at that time he was a little angry with Ronald Reagan because Reagan was very pro, you know, anti-communist, anti-mafia, all that sort of stuff. Do you really think that besides knowing them, he was that involved, or was he part of the gang?
He wasn't part of the gang, and I did extensive research into this, Dana, as you might expect from a former prosecutor.
Yeah.
but he certainly reveled in that culture. He loved the alpha male culture. He loved the code of silence. He loved the oath of loyalty that these folks took to one another. And so he had to associate them from the start because they controlled the entertainment business, the nightclubs and things like that, the theaters. And so there was no getting around associating with them. Other entertainers did, Dean Martin, Tony Bennett, Eddie Fisher, Jerry Lewis. They all did, but Sinatra enjoyed it to the extent that he really sought them out, sought out their company. The most famous incident in which Sinatra really thrust himself into their environment was in 1947 when he hopped a plane in Miami, flew over to Havana, and attended a mafia convention with Lucky Luciano, Meyer Lansky, Frank Costello, Willie Moretti. All the boys were there from all over the country.
And in part of the I don't want to give too much of the book away, but part of the book is some surveillance or a picture of him allegedly carrying a briefcase full of cash and helping out the mob. Was that ever substantiated?
There were unsubstantiated reports of that briefcase that Sinatra carried off the plane from Miami into Havana. Allegations that the FBI picked up on surveillance tapes that they had made at the time that Sinatra was carrying cash into Havana for Lucky Luciano, who was still running the mob in the country, in the U.S. From Havana. He had set up an offshore location there because he had been deported from the U.S. after World War II, but it was never proven, and we really can't say for sure that he had cash. Certainly he was never prosecuted for it.
You know, as a former mayor and in that area, New Jersey, Sinatra, Hoboken, his dad was a fireman for a long time, and you have to look at that story of him growing up, the singing waiter to you know, the band singer to Hollywood to all of this, all the marriages and stuff. Besides his last wife, Ava Gardner, his one true love, or were there many?
There were many liaisons, let's put it, between Sinatra and Hollywood starlets. I mean, in the book, I go over a lot of those associations. Rumor has it that in 1944, when he got a contract with MGM Studios on the MGM lot, he posted on the back of his dressing room door a list of the most desirable actresses in Hollywood, and as he had a conquest of each one, he crossed them off the list. By the time he left MGM, he was fired by them in 1950. He had crossed off all of the names on the list, but Ava Gardner was his one true love. He professed that till the end of time, end of his time anyway. He first started going with her, chasing after her, really, in 1949, and they were together as a couple on and off. He married her. She became his second wife, and she finally divorced him in 1957. But during that 7-8 year period, they were constantly an item. They were fighting constantly in public. They were both heavy drinkers, both quarrelsome, jealous types. So it was a tumultuous relationship, but I guess there was a lot of good to it, too, because Sinatra really stuck with her for that time. She was really the one who dumped him.
My guest this evening is Richard Mutey. He's the author of Cinquanta, the Sinatra Legend at 100, and many other books. The Charmer is one of my favorites. We've done shows on that. And we're talking with Richard about Sinatra and some current events and, well, you name it. One thing that I've found interesting, let's stick on the topic with Sinatra and women a little bit, that I didn't really know, and I thought I knew a little bit about Sinatra, was the Natalie Wood connection and the young girl that she was at the time. Let's talk about that a little bit.
That really shocked me, too. I learned about it for the first time, Dana, when I was researching the book. Picture this. Sinatra had just won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for his role in From Here to Eternity. His career from late 1949, early 1950, had been in the pits. He had taken a severe downturn. His voice had been going. MGM fired him. Columbia Records ended their contract with him. He was having show dates canceled. His voice left him. He was on the stage at the Copacabana nightclub in New York City one night, and his voice came out in a croak, and he simply couldn't sing anymore. But he eventually landed this coveted movie role of Angelo Maggio, the underdog Italian serviceman in pre-World War II Pearl Harbor, Schofield Barracks. And Sinatra really nailed the role. He won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor in March of 1954. In May of 1954, Sinatra, again on the top of the world, begins a sexual relationship with Natalie Wood, then a 15-year-old actress. She, of course, had been the child star in Miracle on 34th Street, you know, that wonderful Christmas movie from the 1940s. You remember that? And she had been acting as a young ingenue teenager, but here Sinatra runs into her in probably the studio commissary or some restaurant, and you know, they start up a sexual relationship. She's 15. He's 38 years old. It's statutory rape, no matter how you cut it. And he's so reckless that he gets involved with her when any public exposure of this relationship could doom him. Just when he really overcame the low point in his career, the extreme recklessness of the action really shocked me. And as I got more into the research, I mean, he was reckless on a number of occasions that really are hard to explain.
Yeah, that was one that, again, without giving it all away, that I was disappointed in, but not surprised at the time. There was other entertainers doing the same thing. But
Errol Flynn did the same thing years earlier. He actually got caught and went to trial. But there were enough women on the jury that they wouldn't convict the handsome, dashing Errol Flynn of anything of the sort.
And, you know, in that Hollywood scandal, and let's talk about today now, with all the paparazzi and the TV shows TMZ and all of that, in the privacy of these stars, and a lot of them solicit the paparazzi to get them their PR that they wanted. Frank Sinatra, it's very interesting, especially in the book, to talk about the gossip columnists. And I think there was one that he even sent a headstone to after writing a story about him. This whole paparazzi thing goes way back, even before today.
Sure. In Sinatra's day, in the 40s, even in the 30s, Hollywood gossip columnists like Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons really ruled the roost in Hollywood. The stars actually cozied up to them in order to get their name in print. Their publicists, they would drop little tidbits. They'd let them know where they're going to be at what restaurants, so their photo would be in the papers. So it was really a double-edged sword of sorts, because you live by that gossip column thing to get your name out there, and you die by it too, because they'll pick up scandal and perpetuate it.
Yeah, for sure. It's fascinating to read the stories, and Sinatra was not one. He's just a little guy, but he was a scrapper that he'd take a swing at you. Or was he not charged with assault one time, or sued for assault, or something with a storyteller?
Yeah, in 1947, soon after he made that Havana trip, a gossip columnist by the name of Mortimer got really beat up by Sinatra and by Sinatra's bodyguards outside a restaurant in Hollywood, outside Ciro's restaurant. Sinatra saw the gossip columnist leaving the restaurant, got up from his table, chased him outside, and hit him from behind. Really beat the heck out of him while his bodyguards held everyone off. This columnist happened to be of slight stature, just as Sinatra was. Actually, Sinatra started fights, but he needed help from his bodyguard to finish them. Sinatra was maybe 130 pounds, 5'7 and a half. And really wasn't too much of a scrapper himself, except starting altercations. But he always had an entourage around him, and especially big beefy guys like Hank Santacola, one of his song pluggers and a acolyte of his, Jilly Rizzo, others like that, always around him.
Do we hear much of, I know with I Have Sirius, so there's a Sinatra channel, and you hear Nancy on there, but do we hear much from Frank Jr. anymore?
He's still out there on the road entertaining. He was here doing a concert in New Jersey in December, which was the month of his father's centennial anniversary, the 100th anniversary of his birth. He was here doing a series of shows, so he's still out there on the road. I'm not sure how active he is. He's 72 now. He's 72. He was born in 1944. Nancy was born in 1940, so she's going to be 76, and I don't think she's active except on the radio.
Yeah, she does little spots on that channel now and then. Author Richard Moody is here, and we're talking about his book, Cent'anni, The Sinatra Legend at 100, and other things. When we were talking on email before this, I promised I would be asking questions about some of the current events going on today, and we were throwing a little bit of that in now and then. But I want to talk about you a little bit, Richard. You go from a wonderful book, The Charmer, to something about Sinatra. I think I know you well enough that you're not sitting down and relaxing right now. What are you working on?
Well, mostly, Dana, I'm promoting this Sinatra book. I want it to be a big success, and it's well on its way to becoming a big success. I've got at least another 30 stops on my book tour in three different states, so I'm going to be busy actively going around promoting. I've got three book signings this week alone. So that's occupying me, but I think probably in June I'm going to be starting another project. I'm tossing around a couple of ideas. Don't necessarily want to let the cat out of the bag just now, but when I do get an idea, I'll email you, and maybe we can chat about it then.
Oh, you bet. You know, and that's just I knew that you wouldn't slow down. You know, speaking of Sinatra, I can think of a couple of TV movies, but has there ever been a motion picture about him?
Not a picture about him per se, but a lot of his movies, some say, were sort of based on his attitude. Pal Joey was Sinatra, almost a Sinatra look-alike in the way that it portrayed this brash young performer singing in nightclubs. There was a made-for-TV series that Sinatra's daughter Christina did, I think, back in the 1990s when Sinatra was still alive.
Yeah, I didn't like that. I know I watched it, and I wasn't sure. Didn't, who played him? I can't think of it now. He's on a new cop show with Jennifer Lopez. Didn't he play Sinatra?
I think his first name was Phil Kasanoff or something.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It's just not the same, but certainly, you know, even your book is certainly Hollywood material, because there's so much of the story. And what's interesting from an author's perspective, Richard, when you do a story like Sinatra, how do you pick the stories to be in the story, because you could probably write 5 books.
Yeah, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of subject of material on the subject. I wanted to get a highly readable story that encapsulates all of the most important aspects of his life, but I wanted it to be in one handy book, so to speak. You know, one good-sized, thorough, well-researched book. I mean, there's another biography out there by James Kaplan that is really a two-volume biography of Sinatra that encompasses some 1,800 pages.
Oh.
And he goes into a great deal of detail, but, you know, you really have to be a committed Sinatra scholar to wend your way through 1,800 pages. I wanted to get something that was fast-paced, that told a story, and I think I've succeeded in that.
Oh, you did, and then some. Let's talk about some current events. Because I respect your opinion, I'd like to hear what you think. Something that they're talking about so much in the news and with this political cycle that's going on right now is immigration, illegal immigration, whatever you want to call it, walls and ICE officers and amnesty and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, you know, it's very interesting to hear a lot what is said. Everyone wants to head to the States to live the dream, but I'm really curious on your opinion on this whole amnesty situation.
Well, it is absolutely impossible, impractical, and every other adjective that you want to use even conceive of the idea of deporting 11 million people who are here without a green card or without proper credentials, undocumented people. It just can't be done. I mean, to hear Trump talk about deporting people, he's going to have a special squad designed to, I guess, go to people's houses, drag them out of the houses, and put them on a bus and take them across the border. I just don't think it can be done. It's not practical. Ted Cruz is also talking about deporting everyone, but he's vague on the details about how it's going to be done and whether he's going to actually go home to home to capture these people and take them away. I just don't see that type of knock on the door in the middle of the night as really an American value being followed. I just don't see it. Certainly there's a problem. I don't like the idea of people coming here legally on visas and then overstaying their visas and just remaining here. The 9/11 hijackers all came here legally on visas and came here without too much of a background check, I guess. I don't like that idea. Perhaps visas need to be more seriously screened. Those seeking visas need seriously screened. I would like to see us, I know Canada is accepting Syrian refugees, and I would like to see the United States do that, but the problem is the vetting process. I'm not sure we can trust things to be done properly. James Comey, once again, the FBI director, made a statement in this regard, and he said he didn't trust it either. He didn't trust the vetting process that we have in place. So that's got to improve. I'd like to see us help these Syrian refugees out, but I'd like to see an improvement in how we make sure that none of them are terrorists who have infiltrated their number.
You know, a lot of the politicians, Richard, talk about making America safe again, being safe, feeling safe. And you, as a former prosecutor, that was part of your job to make Joe and Mary, who lived at home, who just lived their normal life, feel safe, because they knew that a good prosecutor like Richard Muti would be working hard to put that bad guy in jail where he belongs, so to speak. But what about that term, keeping us feeling safe? You think that's able to be done in today's society?
I think you have to strive toward that. Is it 100% guarantee that you're going to be able to make to the American people or to the Canadian people. I don't think it is. I think you have to strive for it, but I think it's perhaps unattainable as a pure goal. I just don't think there is enough of an opportunity or enough of the proper use of resources to attain that goal.
You know, one thing I love about having you on the show is that you stick around, and if you don't mind, would you stick around for another 15 minutes or so?
Sure, I'd love to.
Love to. Richard Moody is here. His book, Chantani, The Sinatra Legend at 100, is available and it's winning awards and doing all sorts of wonderful things. And Richard's going to be out on some book tours, and I can't wait for the next project that comes from that. I want to talk about the news cycle a little bit, you know, in and even up here, because American TV is Canadian TV and vice versa and all that. And you have the left-leading MSNBC and CNN, and then you have the right-leading Fox News, and, of course, the blogs and the stories and all that sort of stuff. Let's talk about television in Sinatra's day. You know, when someone watched a Frank Sinatra show and his rating was 30 million or 40 million people, well, he didn't have that great of luck with TV. But anyway, except when Elvis was on, compared to today with the 500-channel universe and 490 of them are garbage, in my opinion. Let's talk about that news cycle now and then.
Sure, it's a changed world now. It's not only television, but most people are on their phones or on the Internet getting their news or getting their gossip or whatever. That's certainly a big change from Sinatra's day. In Sinatra's day, the television was, two or three networks at the time. That was about it. I try to get my news by watching everything. I watch CNN, I watch Fox News, I watch MSNBC. I like to record the programs on my DVR so that I can fast forward through the crap, if I can say that word.
Sure,
but, I'd like to fast forward through it and get to the meat of the arguments. I, you know, when you listen to these politicians, they're talking their regular campaign spiel all of the time. It's the same stuff over and over again. And you talk about making America safe or Trump's Make America Great Again. I mean, it's a campaign based on slogans with very little substance, and it's not just Trump, it's the other players too are really just spouting off words, and you hear very little of the substance. And I guess that's the atmosphere that we're in right now. That's the universe of politics these days.
And I think it's a trust issue too with you know, the commentators, the news people, and the politicians or the celebrities. You've seen it, I'm sure. Many have. I've seen it. I always smile when I see the Walter Cronkite Frank Sinatra interview from, I guess, probably the early 60s. And just the look on Sinatra's face and some of the outtakes and some of the quotes that you have in the book here. What about that, the trust in that? You know, we don't really have that Walter Cronkite-type newsman anymore, but a lot of it was trust, was it not?
Sure. I mean, Brian Williams on NBC, yeah, was the NBC anchor, and he's embellishing some stories about his exploits, and all of a sudden he's off the air. It's just, you know, a problem. There really aren't any men or women of Cronkite stature, you know, some of the other giants of those days, Frank Reynolds, really stalwart members of the news profession. You just don't see it anymore. I miss it.
Yeah, well, for sure, because you would sit down and I would sit down in Canada and watch Walter Cronkite, because it was someone that you knew you could trust. It was that nightly newscast, David Brinkley and all the John Chancellor and all those guys that were there. You just don't see that nowadays, because news has become so politicized, and it either slides one way or the other. There's no in between, or at least it's hard to find that in between. Richard, when, you know, we've talked politics, we've talked crime, we've talked entertainment and about you, and but the big picture here is Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin. There are not many of those guys left anymore besides, and I'm stretching this a bit, is Tony Bennett still alive, I think, but...
Tony Bennett's still around, a contemporary, well, he was a little younger, but a contemporary of Sinatra's, he was younger. Jerry Lewis is getting up there,
I'm not
sure if he performs any longer, but we're losing that era of performers. You don't see Vic Damone around anymore, I think he's still alive, but Tony Bennett's still performing,
right,
and still has a great voice. But, you know, we have to make do. I guess there's some good performers coming up. I'll listen to my old Sinatra records and CDs in preference, but perhaps the younger generation will see the Harry Connick Jr.'s and the Michael Blue Blaze as something of the next generation of the old ballad singers.
And, you know, and thank goodness you have all these things on the Internet, the Netflixes and the Yahoos and the Hulus. But you can't beat the American movie classics and those types of channels to sit back and see the, like we've mentioned before, one of my favorites is Von Ryan's Express and the others that are out there. But there's no comparison. Again, I'm very jaded from that acting, that group of actors. You talk about From Here to Eternity, the group of actors from there to the group of actors that you have today, I don't think there's any comparison. Do you see another type of Sinatra style of acting in that?
To tell you the truth, I didn't even bother watching the Academy Awards last night.
No.
I watched the first few minutes of Chris Rock's introduction there, and then watched something else. As a matter of fact, I think I watched an old movie on Turner Classic Movies, 7 Days in May. I had it taped on my DVR, and that was Kirk Douglas and Burt Lancaster.
I was in a hotel room the other day, and I come across Mannix, of all things, from the 70s with Mike Connors, and I'm sitting there watching it. My kid walks by and just shakes her head. He said, "Dad, you'll never change." And I said, "Nope, I grew up with this stuff, and I'm going to die with this stuff." That's
feel the same way.
That's the main thing. I don't see an actor. I don't see anyone. You know, and speaking of actors that we've lost, you know, Abe Vigoda from Barney Miller, everybody remembers him. His
uh-huh.
family is disappointed that he wasn't part of the memoriam section of the Academy Awards, and they're so stupid there that they said, "Well, what was he in?" I think The Godfather's a pretty good example of acting. You know,
and he did a great job in that picture.
Absolutely, he did. So, you know, when you lose that era, we're so grateful to have. You know, you can still probably all. After this interview, I'll sit down and watch some Frank Sinatra stuff tonight just because I'm in that mood. But, you know, for your next topic, your next book, your next whatever topic you go for, and I don't want you to spill the beans, so to speak, you want to be able to have something, you know, just a cover alone on your book. Somebody's going to come by in a bookstore and pick it up and say, "Hey, look at this." But how do you grab that topic for the guy that's surfing around on the Internet looking for something to read or walking through that bookstore that you know they're going to pick up, they're going to flip through the pages and take it to the till and buy it?
Well, it takes a lot of work. You've got to do many, many media interviews. And thankfully, I have a spot on your show, I think, when the next book comes out.
You bet, yep.
But you need a great cover design, you need a great subject, and you need a hook. The Sinatra hook, of course, was the 100th anniversary of his birth. And I conceived of the book maybe a year earlier and had to work really hard, 40, 50, 60-hour work weeks in order to get the book done in time to come out in time for the anniversary. So, you know, when you search around for a subject, you want to get, first of all, an interesting subject, but you need a little extra hook in it to make sure that it's going to break into the public consciousness. There's so many things happening that, you know, there's so many things competing for the public's attention that you want to make sure yours surfaces and gets its share of attention.
I've asked many authors on this program over the years, what satisfies you as an author? When you're finished the book, or when you come up with the idea?
Writing the book. I never have a problem with writer's block. As soon as I come up with the idea, I do some research to make sure that's the idea I want to spend the next year with working on it. So I'll start researching a book before I start writing, taking notes, and as I get into it, I'll begin writing as I continue to research. I was researching, 6 months into the writing of the book, I was still doing research, still doing interviews. But once you get committed to the subject, I love writing. As I said, I never sat down at my computer and word processor and had more than 5 minutes of blank time before I started on the keyboard working on the next sentence or the next chapter or whatever. So that's the process I use. I do a lot of writing late at night. I sometimes write until 4, 5, 6 o'clock and then sleep for about 5 or 6 hours and then get up and start some more.
Wow. Well, you know, I want to end up with this. There's a lot of, I want Richard Muti, the prosecutor, to talk to me a little bit now. There's a lot, the last two shows that I've done, a two-part special on this Netflix Making a Murderer, and now with the O.J. Reincarnation, so to speak, on FX, the public fascination with these crimes, and of course it's, you know, they like to push the police incompetence and with the Making a Murderer about this innocent guy that was innocent in the first case, so he must be innocent in the second case, and now rehashing the OJ. I know I interviewed Chris Darden a couple of years ago, and I'm actually going to be interviewing Marcia Clark here in May, talking about her new book. But you got to wonder, I want to ask you, Richard, as a prosecutor, what do you think of this era today of the miniseries and the documentaries about our court system?
Well, the public has always been fascinated by our court system, by true crime books. I mean, it's just part of our culture to be fascinated by that. It's almost like the rubbernecking on a highway when you see an accident on the other side of the median. You want to stop and gawk at it. But the public's interest is there. Certainly, I think their interest in our system of law enforcement and justice is good. I like that idea. I don't necessarily like producers of those series taking liberty with the truth or the facts or the process itself, but I think the public's interest is warranted,
and will be, whether it's The Charmer or whether it's the story of Natalie Holloway or the story of O.J. Simpson or this Netflix special on Making a Murderer. You name it, it'll be there, and it is good. Although I agree with you, the slant sometimes is a bit hard to take. And seeing John Travolta playing Robert Shapiro just it drove me. I had to turn the channel. I couldn't do it anymore. I could not do it. I don't see the catch there. But anyway, listen, I really appreciate it. The book, Centani, the Sinatra legend at 100. My friend Richard Muti, always a pleasure, sir, and you're welcome here anytime.
Thank you very much. And your listeners can always find the latest on my website, richardmuti.com.
You bet. Thanks, Richard.
Thanks, Dana. Take care.
Bye-bye. That's former prosecutor, former mayor, and current author, Richard Muti. And go to richardmuti.com to learn more about this. This Sinatra book is fantastic. I'll hold it up here for the viewers on Access to pick up, and it's fascinating to learn about that individual and one of Richard's books, The Charmer, a crime story. Fantastic crime story, and he's lived it, and I'm sure his next project will be just as wonderful. That's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you all enjoyed it here on Scared Monkeys Radio and Access Channel 7, and we'll see you again real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.